You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll harvest some wild rice on today's edition of Wisconsin Life.
Now, new research shows that in order to lose that, 5 or 10 pounds, whatever you're looking to do, you might need to change your environment. The sight of food, the smell of it, even just a picture of food can make us eat more.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now, as she does once a month, to talk about this and other cool science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you again. Thanks.
So, Gemma, our first story is about the barriers that our environment can throw up for us when it comes to losing weight and not munching and snacking when we don't mean to. What is this story about?
Yeah, the Cinnabon syndrome, if I could call it that. So our writer went out and talks really frankly about her own struggles with weight loss. And then she happened on this little solution that if she controlled her environment so that, the naughty nibblies were as far as possible or just absent from her environment, she was able to lose weight. And she found that science backs her up big time. There have been a lot of studies out on this. Just in 2011, for example, they found that overweight participants in the study didn't overeat if there weren't, temptations actively in their environment. And another famous study from a few years ago, placing candy jars at different places in the office environment, especially if the jar is opaque or clear, that really impacted how many pieces the participants took of the candy. So really controlling your environment appears to be the first step to controlling your weight.
Right, and this is opposed to the idea that, we just need to exercise willpower. Willpower can conquer all. That, in my experience, and I think in a lot of people's experience, fails almost every time.
Absolutely, absolutely. The brain has two different departments when it comes to making a decision, should I eat that or not? Do I want to eat that or not? And one of those systems is called the homeostatic system. And it is the bare bones kind of, okay, body's telling me we need energy. Let's get some energy. Let's get some food into our system. But then we have also the hedonic reward system. And that is basically, ooh, that smells so good. That tastes so good.
Yeah, that's where I usually go.
That.
That's the one I work with a lot.
I think we all do. I don't think any of us have managed to shut that particular system in our brain off. It not only works in tandem with the homeostatic system, making you really want to eat when you're hungry, but even when you're not hungry in the sense that your body does not need extra fuel, that reward system is like, that Cinnabon smells good. That cake looks good.
And in our case of WPR,
donuts. Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like some people, Gemma, have an even stronger response to those rewards than other people, and that might be bad news down the road for weight gain.
Yeah, there was a study in 2015 where they gave adolescents chocolate milkshakes and then stuck them in a fMRI scan. Those are the functional MRIs that allow you to actually see the brain's activity, not just a static image, but during something that the person's doing. So they gave them these delicious chocolate milkshakes, stuck them in the fMRI, and found that certain people had elevated responses. They just really were into that chocolate milkshake. Their brain was like, oh, yeah. And that actually predicted fat gain 3 years later. So from person to person, there are different responses. But understanding where those responses come from and how they work, which we don't fully understand yet, but that is, again, a big step toward really getting a handle on our desire for that donut.
So, of course, my takeaway now, I want a chocolate milkshake. Thanks, Gemma.
You know what? I've struggled with food all my life, but I got to say, I hate chocolate. So, sure, put that chocolate milkshake in front of me. I'm good.
Okay.
It's not going anywhere.
Right. And so Rob isn't kidding. If he sees a picture of chocolate milk,
yep,
he wants chocolate milk. And that's true for a
really?
Lot of people, right? If you smell it, you see it, you want it.
Yeah, and you know, the smell thing. I mean, we all know that the restaurants, whether it's a barbecue place with a smoker in the back or McDonald's pumping out the scent of fries, or again, Cinnabon. I'm picking on Cinnabon a lot today, but they're just one of the, you know, they have that odor. As you could smell it all the way down the food court. And that's why a lot of restaurants pump out those smells, because they know that's an incredibly enticing smell.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most interesting stories from the world of science. And Gemma, speaking of weight loss, when we think of spaceships, we might think of, you know, Millennium Falcon, the Starship Enterprise. Well, a new program and effort is going to try to work with much smaller spaceships to try to get some contact with a neighboring star system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there is no room for Chewbacca on these nanocraft, let me tell you. So it's really exciting, and it's actually perfect timing, because back in April, there was this board of very famous people. You had Stephen Hawking and astrophysicist Avi Loeb and all these people saying, hey, it is possible for us to get to our nearest star system, which is Alpha Centauri, to get there within 20 years. And this is kind of a moment. But yeah, the plan is not to actually send astronauts there, but they really think we can send thousands of these nanocraft. They're in development now. Some of the pieces are already done and tested. Others are still in development. But basically, they would cost about $25 per unit, and they're tiny. They're wafer thin and only a couple grams, so you could probably pack, I don't know, maybe 12 of them per ounce. They're that small. And they've got these, you know, tiny, tiny electronics, cameras and such. And we think it's possible to send thousands of them at 20% the speed of light. That might not sound like much, but that is about 134 million miles per hour. That's crazy fast. And we think we could, or the team Breakthrough Starshot is the name, and they think they can get them from Earth to the Alpha Centauri system in about 20 years.
And it's kind of incredible, the technology they're talking about. As you said, it's not quite there, some of it, but it involves sort of space sailing. How would that work?
Well, okay, so it's a little hard to picture if you're not that familiar with it, but if you imagine this little wafer-sized nanocraft, it's, you know, maybe, I don't know, like a square, like a really big postage stamp maybe, and they attach it to a sail, and the sail, they think it's going to be about 12 feet across, and they put it on a rocket, throw these things up into space on the rocket, and so they're in Earth orbit, and then they've got a laser array on the ground, just hundreds, if not thousands, of lasers, and they aim the lasers at the units, at the nanocraft and their sails, and just, boom, they use light to power them, and so they accelerate to this, you know, 20% light year speed, and that's how, you know, to give you an idea of how fast that is, you know how New Horizons passed Pluto last year, and we were so excited because it was the culmination of 10 years of waiting for this craft to get to Pluto?
Mm-hmm.
These nanocraft get to Pluto in, they think, about 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah, that's so, how, we're talking fast with a capital F.
We've got these tiny wafers. We've got them to Alpha Centauri. It seems like they're so small. Could they really do get information there and send it back to us, or are we just figuring out a way to litter our neighboring solar systems?
You know, when I first heard about this program, I just had this image of, you know, during World War II when the planes were dropping pamphlets, like propaganda pamphlets, and they were just like littering the streets of Germany and things. I just had this image of, wow. You know, is that what any life in the Centauri system is going to think? But no, actually, you know, microelectronics are so advanced now that they can fit a camera, they can fit a magnetometer, they can fit all this equipment into this teeny tiny wafer-sized, you know, 3 to 4 gram nanocraft.
And Gemma, just real quickly before we go on to our next story, what might we learn if everything works exactly as planned?
Well, if everything works as planned, and they think they can actually launch them in about 20 years, and then 20 years after that, they would actually arrive at Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star of the three stars in the Alpha Centauri system. And that is super, super exciting, because in August, we found a planet, an exoplanet called Proxima B, that is orbiting Proxima Centauri, that looks like it has everything needed to sustain life. So it's pretty exciting. They don't know that it's definitely got life, or even that it's definitely a rocky planet, but all signs are that this is a hugely promising planet to explore for life. And it would be basically the first thing these little nanocraft would be able to see in the Centauri system.
And Gemma, before we wrap up, one more story we wanted to touch on. Take us on a quick visit to Mammoth Island.
Yeah. So there are these islands way, way, way up off the Alaskan coast, the Pribilofs. And on one of these islands, researchers found a mammoth tooth that was just about 6,500 years old. Now, the crazy thing is, we thought mammoths in North America went extinct more than 10,000 years ago. So they're like, hey, what's this tooth doing? It's only 6,500 years old. And the researcher went back after finding the tooth with this multidisciplinary team that gathered sediment cores from one of the lakes on the island. And it's really incredible how, you know, the team split up just pieces of the mud core that they gathered and ran all different kinds of tests. They were able to detect things like the pollen, the diatoms, which, you know, like the water fleas, and even mammoth DNA, all preserved in these sediments. And they were able not only to reconstruct the environment that these mammoths were in, but how it changed over time, and eventually why and how they went extinct so much later than on the North American mainland.
And they think they've got an answer about why they went extinct and maybe why they lived longer. So what did they find?
Yeah, well, you know, this area, this particular area that's now St. Paul Island, it was once attached to the North American mainland, to what's now Alaska. And then about 11,500 years ago, the water level rose, and so it became an island, and it became isolated from whatever was killing the mammoths off on the North American mainland. We're not sure about what that was, but still, these mammoths were insulated from that. Now, the great thing is they're insulated because they're on an island, but over time, that island became kind of a trap for them because their watering hole basically dried up over time, and they can actually see this in the sediment record by changes in pollen, changes in mud, changes in, you know, the microbes that were living in the water at that time. So basically, the mammoths, and this is so tragic, they survived their North American counterparts only to die of thirst about, we think, 5,600 years ago.
Well, Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about the coolest news from the world of science.